This is Game of Thrones 2, Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, I will be covering Catelyn's third point of view chapter. This is the famous Cat's Paw attack with Alexis Goebel. Alexis, as you will know already, is a Bald Move regular. She's covered His Dark Materials and Better Cast Saul. And I'll be looking at The Ghost of Harrenhal with comic Steve Osborne. Without further ado, here is Boss Man Aeron.
Ask Aeron anything!
Best villain Aeron in TV or cinematic history?
Of all time?
Yeah. Dan, just so everyone knows, Aeron has not seen any of these questions ahead of time. Where he is on the hot seat.
Yeah. let's see.
While you're thinking about it, I'm going to tell you who Ebert's was.
Yeah.
Ebert had a great answer for this, and I wish that, like, oh, that's so good. That's why you're Ebert. He said the HAL 9000 was the best villain in cinematic history.
I was going to say, like, the thing that popped in my mind was Patricia Clarkson as Adora Krellen from HBO's Sharp Objects miniseries. Because I've been doing the best of Baldies, the mega Baldies, and I've been and I'm like, chilling. God damn, that woman's pure evil and like multi generational evil.
Yes. Yes.
And like, yeah.
Actually, are
like,
you saying the mom or the daughter?
The mom.
Okay, I don't want to reveal anything about the show. If you haven't seen Sharp Objects, it's totally worth a watch. Mm-hmm. But I was actually not going to say the mother. I was going to say the daughter. But
see, right. it's a Roose-Ramsay debate. You know, who's the worst, right. the tool or the craftsman who made it?
All right. So what's your? Oh, so that was the one that you were gonna. I mean, that can't be the best, right?
I mean, that's the one that just like when you said the words, it came to my mind. I mean, if I go like best, like, gee whiz, like, you know, I'll probably say something stupid like Darth Vader. You know,
honestly, you could do worse. Darth Vader would be my choice. Darth Vader, I think, is the best villain in film history. Now, I will say this. There could be an argument to be made that he's really an anti-hero.
True.
But honestly, you know, you just start the mythology with episode 4 and 5 or whatever. Uh-huh. There's no doubt he's the villain.
Yeah, he murdered like every Jedi youngling there was at the temple because Palpatine just said so, you know? Like, I think that I will say this, that if Marvel, well, I guess Sony Pictures, whatever, Fox, the squabbling parents that had custody over the character, and they had done a more consistent job of the characterization of Magneto, it'd be hard to beat Magneto, because I like a villain who kind of has a point. Like, it's an insane way to look at the world, but also the world that he came from was insane. Magneto's pretty freaking good. That's why.
So we just did my son and I just did a rewatch of Spider-Man Homecoming yesterday. Mm-hmm. Boy, Michael Keaton's just fantastic.
He is.
I didn't really remember him being as good as he was in that movie, but he's the guy. Yeah. He's the guy you're talking about. That guy has a point. He's doing everything Tony Stark's doing. He's just a little bit.
That's essentially the Sabatka guy from season 2 of The Wire. He just found bionic wings, you know? And that's Michael Keaton is so good, especially when you keep in mind that he was Batman and also Birdman.
Yeah.
I fucking love that he actually is literally a Birdman in the Spider-Man movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you have a question for Aeron or Anthony, you can send those to book@baldmove.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Alexis, I'd like to play a game with you if you're up for it.
I am always up for games. What do you have for me?
This is a game called Underrated, Overrated, or Properly Rated. Okay, so I'm just going to name something, and then you're going to tell me whether it's overrated, underrated, or properly rated.
This is going to get me in trouble with people, but okay, let's do it.
Of course, of course. All right, first thing I'm going to ask is Breaking Bad. Overrated, underrated, or properly rated?
It is rated exactly the way it needs to be. Properly rated.
Properly rated. I'm guessing that you're a big fan of Breaking Bad, and rightly so.
Yes, I am. I love the way the show, once it starts going, it does not stop going until it stops.
Yeah, sure. All right, I'm glad. Okay. Overrated, underrated, or properly rated herbal tea?
For me, it's underrated. If you asked my lovely husband, he would say overrated, and he would be wrong. He would be wrong. I'm correct. So I love herbal tea.
Jim is not a fan of herbal tea.
He isn't. He doesn't like to drink flowers.
Yeah, so he doesn't like tea at all.
He likes the leaf tea. He likes proper tea.
Okay. All right. Yeah, sure. Earl Grey or English breakfast or something like that.
Or green tea. Yeah.
Or green tea. All right. Yeah. All right. Okay. But you're a fan of herbal tea.
Yeah, I like it a lot. I get some satisfaction from the slightly medicinal taste of it. I feel like I'm doing something good for myself.
It does feel a little bit like you're an adult when you're drinking herbal tea.
Exactly. Yeah. And I need to get that wherever I can.
Now, are you the kind of person who buys like 14 different kinds so you can have a lot of different options, or do you have like one go-to herbal tea?
I do like to have a lot of options.
Okay. All right.
Definitely. But you can't buy too much at once because it starts to lose its flavor after a while.
All right. Okay. I'm not, honestly, I didn't know that. I should know that.
It's just like spices. It starts to break down. It loses its integrity the more it's exposed to oxygen.
I see. Okay. I'm not a big tea drinker. When I lived in England, I was. It was like a daily thing.
Of course. Yeah.
I don't know if it was just a when in Rome thing or if it was just like, I'm not going to be able to find the coffee that I like here. So I'm just going to go with the tea. I don't know. It's probably like I wanted to feel a little bit British.
Well, the weather, I think, is very conducive to tea drinking too.
There you go.
Because it's cold and drizzly all the time. And you just like, you need to get warmth from somewhere. You need to keep your core temperature. Otherwise, you're just going to like jump off a bridge or something.
Exactly. You know, I'm glad that you said that because I think about Winston Churchill a little bit differently than I once did. I think that, you know, how he took like frequent baths. I don't know if you know that about him. I think he was trying to get warm.
Probably.
Like if he lived in like Phoenix or whatever, I bet you he would have taken showers. Historians will need to debate this.
They probably have debated it and we just haven't read it.
Okay, so Alexis, we are covering Catelyn. This is chapter 14.
Mm-hmm.
This is her third POV chapter. Do I have that right?
Number I believe three? So.
Okay. This is a very wolf-heavy chapter.
Sure is.
And you you have strong opinions about these direwolves, Alexis. Am I right in thinking that?
If my strong opinions are that I love them and I want to protect them with my life, then yes.
Yeah, so this chapter is I think it's the first indication or at least little hint that there's some connection between Bran and Summer, even though Summer doesn't have a name yet. You do get the sense that, okay, this wolf knows to protect Bran, and even then Kat kind of thinks, oh, well, that makes sense. It's Bran's wolf. And I think at this point, you could kind of take that as, well, it's its pet. But not for very long. I mean,
yeah,
he hasn't even named the dog yet, right?
I know. Yeah, I think this is the first chapter where you start to suspect that something other than natural is happening with the wolves and the kids.
Yeah, right. So part of Martin's genius is these little slow reveals over time.
Right.
Like, for instance, we hear Hodor mentioned in this chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're not going to find out till, you know, much later why he's even named Hodor, right?
Right.
But he loves to plant these little seeds for astute readers to kind of wonder about. But he's not going to quite show you what they become till much, much later in the story.
He's very good at that. He's very good at dropping those subtle hints that you don't really realize are subtle hints until after the fact.
Yeah. So I think, given that that's kind of his way, I think we are supposed to notice that Bran has some connection to this wolf that's a little bit different than, you know, sort of a pet owner relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so here's my synopsis. Catelyn is at Bran's bedside. Bran is still comatose. She hasn't left the room in several days. Maester Luwin bothers her with some bookkeeping and personnel issues, but she singularly focuses on Bran and refuses to engage. Rob steps in and tries to act lordly. The wolves howl outside. Cat, who's sleep deprived, collapses. Then Rob notices a fire in the library tower and runs out. And Catelyn is observing out the window. A man with a knife shows up to kill Bran. Cat tries to defend her son and ends up on the wrong side of the knife. She manages to hold the knife's edge long enough for Bran's nameless wolf to rip the man's throat out. Cat wakes. After seeing that the knife is rare and expensive, she explains her suspicions to Rob about Bran's fall and the conspiracy with the Lannisters. She tells this to Theon and company, swearing them to secrecy. Finally, she decides to go south to learn more about the knife and the conspiracy behind it. And that's my synopsis. What do you think?
Very well synopsized.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. All right. Yeah, good. All right. So, guest choice. You could talk, Alexa.
Ladder of Chaos.
All right, good. So what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about how interesting it is to have a character have a baptism by fire, but not actually be in a fire.
Say lots more.
So the fire's in the library and Catelyn is not.
Uh-huh.
But mostly this is kind of her first BAMF moment, right? Uh-huh. This is the moment where she decides to take control of her own narrative.
Right.
The beginning of the chapter, she is in a lot of ways overwhelmed by the choices that have been presented to her. I don't think anybody expects for these things to happen in their lives.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Especially not someone who thought that she would just be a wife and a mother and then die eventually.
Sure. I think you're probably right, and I'm glad that you said that. Here's what I wrote down. At the beginning of this chapter, she's like double-minded. She's a double-minded person. And I think that she's just kind of been thrown into chaos by Bran's fall.
Mm-hmm.
So she's double-minded on whether Ned should have stayed. Should he go? Yes, that was her original take on it. In fact, she was pretty adamant about it.
Mm-hmm.
But then after Bran fell, she thinks Ned should have stayed. So she's kind of double-minded there. And then at the end, she decides to leave Bran. So she's a little bit, you're getting kind of mixed signals on that business. And also, should the wolf be allowed in the room? She really does care about Winterfell, you know, the runnings of Winterfell. But in this moment, she really doesn't care about it. In fact, at one point, she just, she says she wants to kill all the horses and the wolves. So
totally normal.
But by the end of the chapter, she's not a woman of two minds.
Right.
She is like laser beam focused on the South.
Exactly.
All right. Now this is going to be too cute by half, but you used the metaphor of baptism by fire. You could say that she's a woman on the edge of a knife.
Ugh. Yes. You know,
she could decide to fall into a sort of a domestic motherly role, or she could kind of return to her political machinations in the South. And she clearly chooses one over the other, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, you've got this whole literal knife thing happening.
Yes, I do see what you did there. And I kind of appreciate it.
Okay, well, I don't want you to appreciate it too much because then
I appreciate it. Listen, exactly the appropriate amount.
Good, good. Properly rated.
Yes.
Metaphor. All right. I want to know from you, am I supposed to like Catelyn at this point?
Yeah, that's a really good question because I sure didn't like her at this point in the book the first time I read it.
For what reasons? I'm guessing it has to do with John.
It does have a lot to do with John. I understand why she is so cold toward him, but also he's just a kid. It's not his fault that he is a quote-unquote bastard. So there's that. And also her waffling at the beginning of the scene always got on my nerves. Again, you understand why it's happening, but also
yeah.
It's very strangely portrayed. It's like she loses her mind for a minute.
I wonder if I think I always had the same impression of Kat, but after reading this chapter, I think this is not how she normally acts.
Right.
And I think that maybe she kind of has been giving John subtle hints that he's not welcome. But then after this happens to Bran, she's kind of like a raw nerve in that she's just saying everything without a filter. So I don't know if she's always this openly hostile to John. But my first impression of her, of course, is that she's very political. She has a very strong sense of what Ned ought to do, you know, mm-hmm. how Ned ought to do his duty. And then she's just horrible to John, right?
Yeah, she really is.
But I wonder if I should forgive some of that because she's, you know, she's in this horrific state.
Well, the way John would describe it, she is always cold toward him. I don't know, like you said, yeah. If it's so much the outright, I don't like you, you little bastard. But definitely, he doesn't get to eat anywhere near his siblings.
Yeah.
He has to sit at the end of the hall with all the other, like, pages and stuff.
Uh-huh. There's part of me that doesn't like Kat for that reason, but I like Kat for so many other reasons.
I definitely think she has a ton of redeeming qualities.
I think she's super smart. I think mm-hmm. that in the book she's supposed to be super smart. And I think that we get the sense here that Rob is not so smart.
Rob is 14 years old. He's very much still a teenager. And she herself says, oh, I forgot. You're just 14. You're not actually a lord of a castle yet.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he's trying. He's trying
but also he says, I need you too, Mom. Could you pull it together for a second?
Right. I think he doesn't want to be Rickon's. He doesn't want Rickon hanging all over him. I think that's part of it.
Definitely. He has armor now. He's carrying a weapon. He's kind of feeling like, I don't know, he's the lord of the house. I think Eddard even said when he left, you're the man of the house now.
Right.
So he's feeling that responsibility, but...
Do you get the sense that, like, there's really no reason to be carrying a sword around, but it's like it's his first real steel?
Yeah, I think it's just like, I don't know, it's like long pants in the UK. it's his long metal pants.
Yeah, okay.
But just one, and it's not on his leg.
Right, so it's kind of like, she notices twice that he's wearing a sword,
mm-hmm.
and it's kind of like, Rob, put the sword away, man. You don't need to carry it everywhere. However,
he brandishes it, doesn't he? And she's like, you don't do that. Just put it away, son.
Well, and I think that Roderick even says something like, it don't ever pull out that sword unless you intend to use it.
It was Roderick, yeah.
Yeah, so, and then Kat basically says, well, you might need to use it, suggesting that they may have to go to war or something. I mean, she's serious. She's serious about the whole thing. I really feel like Catelyn is so much more interesting on the page than she is on the screen.
Well, that's adaptation, right? Because on the page, we can see inside her head. We know what she's thinking. And on the screen, all we have is what the writers and directors have decided to give us.
Here's my main issue. I think what motivates Catelyn in the book
is fundamentally different than what motivates Catelyn in the show. I think what motivates Catelyn in the book is she wants to figure out all of these sort of conspiratorial things that are happening down south. And I don't think she trusts Ned to figure them out. And I think she feels like, I'm a political creature of the South. If you want this job done, I'm going to go do it. I'm going to go figure it out. I'm going to capture Tyrion. I'm going to, you know, outsmart everyone. Mm-hmm. That's what motivates her in the book is the Game of Thrones.
Sure.
I think what motivates her in the show is sort of this protective, like, I'm going to protect my husband. I want to protect my children.
It's very maternal, which
it's too maternal.
Yeah.
I mean, we saw in this chapter, she decides, Bran's fine.
I know. She went through all of that and then she's like, here's a new mystery. There's something else to do.
She lapses into sort of her maternal, like motherly nurturing. But then when she reclaims her Catelyn, you know, I don't know, personality.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, I've done all I can for this kid. Rob, you take care of Rickon. Roderick and I, we're heading south to save the day.
Yeah, I'm taking the last good fighter you have, and I'm going south.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So I don't know. I like the book better.
In this case, and in a lot of cases, I'm sure.
A lot of cases, especially with this book, because there's no errant plot threads. Whereas, like in the later books, it's like, where is this going, Martin?
Right. Yeah. It is. It feels a lot tighter, and it does start to unravel.
This first book is really tight. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So here's my case for Rob being a little bit smarter than he gets credit for. So he wants to open the windows and let the listen to the wolves howl.
Mm-hmm.
And he thinks that this is going to do something for Bran. I don't know if I think he maybe just intuits that the wolves are important for Bran.
I thought that was an interesting choice because I don't know why anybody would think that that would help.
Right. Like he says, you know, she says, he's going to be too cold, which would be common sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he says, no, he needs to hear the wolves howl, which sounds like some 14-year-old nonsense.
Yeah, it's some magical bullshit is what you're saying.
Yes. Yes. However, we find out later that Bran seems to improve when the wolf is closer to him.
Right. At the very least.
At the very least.
He has his life saved by it.
Yes, that's right. That's right. So the wolf ends up saving the day, right?
Mm-hmm.
Suggesting that Kat maybe is not in the right to want to butcher all of the animals in all of Winterfell.
Boy, it's an interesting conclusion to come to, but I could see how she got there.
Yeah, it's got to be annoying. I mean, even Tyrion thought the wolf howling was disconcerting when he was at Winterfell.
No, of course he did. He's a snack.
He is a bite-sized
morsel. I mean that in multiple ways. But the regular spelling and the spelling with two C's.
Okay.
He's a snack. Right.
We have you on the record. Very good. Very good. All right. So I just want to point out a few notable introductions. Halas Mullen.
Mm.
Not that anyone cares about Halas Mullen, but he is introduced for the first time here. And then more notably, the famed Valyrian steel knife with the dragon bone handle.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, yes, this is the okay. I want to ask you about this.
Yeah.
The knife, a lot's made of this knife, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's very unique. I always felt like this is, it's almost too obvious of a plant. Like, I feel like most of the people in the story are pretending or at least thinking, like, oh, whoever tried to murder Bran really messed up by giving this cutthroat this fancy knife, because now we're going to be able to track where this knife came from.
Right, it's Valyrian steel. There's only
four
or five of those.
When in reality, what they should be thinking is, this knife is meant to point us in the wrong direction. And I feel like if these characters in the story are smart, they wouldn't be thinking, the criminal messed up and gave the person too fancy of a knife. They should be thinking, this knife is way too fancy and is probably meant to mislead us.
You would think so. You would think.
But I don't know whether it's just like, okay, so I've read the book a couple times and now I'm smarter than everyone in the story.
I don't know. You're playing chess in there over here, still playing checkers.
Yeah. What is your thought on this?
My opinion on that changes depending on which explanation you want to go with. I feel like the books and the show give two different explanations for who actually put this dagger into play.
Tell me more about that.
In the book, they eventually, I think it's pretty settled, but maybe not. I don't know. Maybe I'm speaking out of my butt here. But in the book, it seems like they're pointing toward Joffrey. And that's why it's such a fancy, like, he chose the least fancy dagger out of Robert's wagons whenever they came to Winterfell. But the least obvious dagger was still a Valyrian steel dagger. And maybe he just didn't know enough to know that that was the case.
Right. Yes. Okay.
Whereas in the show, they make it pretty clear that it was Littlefinger.
Littlefinger really is, I mean, Littlefinger's involved in a few different assassination attempts, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But he's always doing it with, like I say, a cat's paw. He's always doing it with a proxy.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it could be a both and scenario where Littlefinger's involved.
Right.
And maybe Littlefinger should get the lion's share of the credit in the end. I'm not really sure how to read that, but I'm glad you pointed that out for sure.
Yeah, it's interesting. Plus, we don't know. Also, the books aren't finished yet. Maybe it was Littlefinger.
Yeah. Which one? Okay, so which one is more interesting to you?
Considering the fact that Joffrey is, like, super dead,
yeah.
I think it's more interesting to have Littlefinger, to have the, you know, it's two steps removed from the truth. It's still a very fancy dagger.
Right. Yeah.
So he is trying to mislead.
Sure. Now, Kat thinks... Sometimes Martin will do these clever little things, right? So right now they're still trying to figure out how John Arryn died.
Mm-hmm.
We will eventually learn that he died by this poison called the Tears of Lys or the Tears of Lice or something.
Yeah.
And it's spelled L-Y-S, which is exactly how Lysa Arryn spells her name.
Oh, that's... I never made that connection before. All right. So then
let me ask you this question. Is Kat the cat's paw, or is the knife the cat's paw? Because if Kat is the cat's paw, that kind of fits with Martin's little, you know, name game.
It does. If Littlefinger was trying to pull her away from Winterfell.
Well, if he wants to incite a war between the Lannisters and the Starks,
right,
and he knows that she's a firebrand... You know, or a mama bear or something. And he knows, okay, I know her well enough to know that if I poke her just a little bit,
mm-hmm,
she will go into a murderous rage.
I mean, he's definitely so trying to...
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, if that's the case, then she's the cat's paw and her name is Kat.
I like it. Because we know that he is trying to pit the Lannisters and the Starks against each other. He tells her himself, got his mouth dirty, if not his hands. He tells her that the dagger was Tyrion's, yeah, or that now Tyrion won it from him.
Right. Now this assumes that Littlefinger is involved, and I think he is because Catelyn gets this letter from her sister, and her sister warns her that the Lannisters killed Jon Arryn. We know that that's not true at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that Lysa is kind of enamored with Littlefinger and all that business. So I'm going to go with the both and situation here. I think Littlefinger is involved in some way.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, there's just too much evidence pointing toward it.
Yeah, sure. Okay. All right. I'm glad I didn't have to fight you on that. Too early in the morning.
It is.
Such things. I thought it was interesting to see Theon and Roderick in the same room together and, being chummy.
Yeah, it makes sense. He's the master of arms, right?
He's the master of arms, and Theon in the books is a little bit older than Ned's sons, right?
He is, yeah. He's maybe late teens or early 20s.
Yeah, I think he was like 18 or 19 or something like that. I think on first read, I probably liked Theon at this point.
Yeah, he's a little cocky, but
he's a little bit sure of himself. He's a little bit too cocky, but he's the only one that has a sense of humor in Winterfell at this point.
Yeah. He hasn't had it frozen off of him yet.
Yeah, right. You kind of get the sense with these Starks that they're not, I don't know. Are they people that you want to drink with? Would you want to have a beer with any of these Starks?
I think Ned's okay. Like I think he presents a very tough, cold front.
Yeah.
But I think beneath that, there's a lot of warmth. Maybe not so much humor, but definitely warmth. I feel like he's probably a nice person.
Maybe so, but I kind of feel like he's always got his, almost always got his either like solemn fatherly face on or solemn lordly face on.
Yeah.
I don't think he'd be good to hang out with.
I think you'd have to be related to him for him to be good to hang out with.
At this point in the story, if I wanted to hang with anyone, it'd probably be Theon.
Yeah, I would give you that. I was going to say John, but at this point in the story, John is doing the whole teenage angst thing.
He's crying. He's getting,
He's a little whiny. He's getting drunk. Suffering. He's running off.
Yeah, well, for all good reasons. But
definitely.
Yeah, so Theon at this point is not... I really do think that Theon is meant to, at this point, seem like an ally. And in the show, Kat seems to distrust Theon, like, just at his core.
Yeah.
Whereas here, she tells him this secret that can't go out of the room. Like, she trusts Theon with this huge secret. And you get the sense that Kat is pretty, in the book at least, she's being really careful with these secrets. Like, she gets the note in the mail, and it's written in a secret language that only she and Lysa know, and then she immediately burns the note.
Mm-hmm.
So you get the sense she's actually being really careful, or at least she's trying to be really careful with these secrets. And then she confides in a small group of men in her bedchamber. One of these men is Theon.
I do feel like in the books, whenever Theon sort of turns his coat inside out and says, "Oh, just kidding, I was a squid the whole time," it does come as kind of a shock, because he seems so loyal in these first scenes with him. And I wonder if maybe in the show they were trying to mitigate that a little bit by having her be immediately distrustful of him.
Maybe that's so. All right. So I feel like in the books, at this point, I kind of like him.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he's kind of like, John calls him an ass at one point. He is kind of an ass.
Yeah. Kicking the head was kind of gross in that first chapter.
It's kind of gross. He also wants to kill the wolves.
Yeah.
So, but I kind of feel like I'm interested in this guy. I'm a little bit interested to see where this guy goes. Whereas I think that the show, you're probably right, he's probably more interesting earlier than he is later in the story. Alexis.
Yes. Anthony.
I want to ask you a final question.
Okay.
Out of all the characters in all of Ice and Fire, the character who your friends and family think you are, versus the character deep down inside you know you really are.
Gonna have to think of this in terms of gender bending, probably, because there are like four women, six maybe. So they...
Oh yeah, you got to gender bend, because I've so much affinity for Arya. I just feel like There's no one in the show or the books that I'm more connected to than Arya.
I love Arya. She was always my favorite. I wouldn't go so far as to say that I think I'm her, though. She's much too perfect in every way, and I wouldn't describe myself in that way.
You wish that you could be a better murderer? Is that what you're saying?
No, I just wish I could be more slippery, I guess. A little more able to master my facial features and lie, I guess. Yeah, that does sound kind of bad, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, she's kind of a ninja.
She's kind of a ninja.
That's pretty awesome.
I would say my family and friends would think that I am Sam Tarly.
Okay.
And I think that I am Brienne of Tarth.
Okay. So, all right. So which attributes of Sam Tarly would they think of you?
Bookish, awkward. We'll probably never get laid. You'll note that both of these characters are the probably would never get laid types.
Well, they could solve each other's problem.
I suppose.
I doubt it, but
yeah. I think she likes prettier men.
I think she probably does too.
Apparently.
All right, so Sam Tarly, bookish, awkward.
Mm-hmm.
He's smart, but his intelligence is sometimes a liability, right?
Why do you say that?
Well, because I mean, there are people in this story who are super smart, but they are also pretty savvy to like not reveal themselves to be too smart. Like if Sam was a little bit less bookish, maybe his father wouldn't have tried to murder him and send him to the wall or whatever.
Sure.
Or threaten to murder him, right?
Right.
And I think that as sort of a man of the Night's Watch.
Definitely, yeah. He doesn't know how to hide that.
Like maybe he shouldn't reveal that he's so bookish to these men. He doesn't know how to hide it, right? So are you like that?
I think so. I think I sometimes get excited that I know something and just blurt it out without thinking about the the circumstances around me.
All right, so you could say Brienne is somewhat gender bending as well.
A little bit, yeah.
So what attributes of Brienne do you see in yourself?
Scrappy. She's sort of, I mean, she's big, but she's also scrappy. She's a survivor. She's tough. And maybe not necessarily as bright as a Sam Tarly.
I don't know if, well, she's not as smart as Sam. She's, well, not many people are as smart as Sam. But right. I don't know if she's not smart.
No, I wouldn't call her like dumb or anything. I think she is exactly as smart as she needs to be for who she is.
When I think of Brienne, I think of her being humorless.
Okay, yeah, that doesn't actually fit me that well in retrospect.
But it could be that's sort of born out of her insecurity. Like if she was sort of like a couple pints in and around people that she trusted.
I love whenever we get to see her and Podrick together. Those are some of my favorite scenes.
That was a really great little duo.
Yeah, it was.
I love that. I one of my favorite scenes of the entire series is when she is finally knighted by Jaime.
Yeah, that I actually cried. It was very sweet.
It was such a wonderful scene. And I just did a rewatch recently and I teared up and I thought, you know what? For all of the sometimes justified maligning that the final season gets, or the final two seasons get, that was just a wonderful scene. I mean, that final season has a few like really wonderful moments.
It does. It has a lot of very satisfying kind of almost, what's the word? Fan service moments.
Fan service, yes.
But also it serves the plot.
It serves her character arc really well.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's actually quite a wonderful way to conclude her story. I wasn't a huge fan of then having her hook up with Jamie, but that's my own little.
Yeah, I didn't like that either, so especially to have her do that and then to have him turn around and go straight back to Cersei. Although that makes sense, but it was also
kind of
gross.
Of his character, but yeah. Again, I love that, and I love that finally. So he is able to give her what she's always wanted, but kind of has never been able to name. Like even in that scene, like she doesn't even want to say that she wants to be a knight, and then Pod's kind of looking at her like, "What are you talking about? Of course you want to be a knight,
right?"
And that so much happens with his eyes in that scene. That was wonderful. And then she ends up reciprocating because then she ends up filling in Jamie's pages.
Yeah.
At the end. And so she's able to give him at least the more complicated legacy that he deserves rather than just being known as the Kingslayer. So I thought that was brilliantly done. And, you know, say what you will about the final season, but
oh, people have.
They have, and they will continue. But I did love that little exchange. So
it was great.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was, and those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues, but then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question: who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. First two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV Plus, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We saw Roderick Sideburns again, dude.
Yeah, they showed up, and they did not disappoint.
Now, in the book, he shaves those sideburns right off.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a very important detail because they're so distinctive that if he wants to go incognito, like when he goes south.
Right. Of course, I mean,
he's the only one in the kingdom with these sideburns, man.
It's this Clark Kent Superman situation, right?
It's like if you were Dwayne from a different world.
Oh, yeah. And you get contacts.
Yeah, that's right. You take off those flip glasses. No one knows who you are.
Right.
So if you want to go incognito, you can't wear those flip glasses. That's your look.
Yeah, not only are you incognito, but you're not interesting anymore.
All right. So, yeah. So we saw Roderick's sideburns again. And I think we're bearing the lead here. The smoke baby became a smoke man and then became a smoke assassin.
And then bounced.
Yeah, he was gone. That was it for him.
Okay, so here we go, right? Renly is kind of, you know, he doesn't want to yield anything to the Starks, and he's making a case. And then Smoke Man comes in, kills Renly, leaves. And I kind of feel like this is where I'm, you know, I'm willing to go on the magical journey, but I'm kind of like, I feel like that Smoke Man could have done a little more work.
That's a lot of setup for Smoke Man.
Yeah. Smoke Man went through a lot. He grew up. He could have been a smoke teen. Still, we don't know. But he comes in and he...
Well, he knew how to leave on a high note.
Well, yeah. But I just feel like, you know, it's like, well, while I'm here in smoke form and no one probably know, like, no one's formulated a plan for, like, how do we destroy the Smoke Man? Smoke Man's brand new. Smoke Man, I feel like, could have just sauntered through tents and just wiped up. But I guess they want the army, right? But I feel like there could have been more work.
It could be like Smoke Man is a little bit ADHD. It's like you give him one step of instructions.
Yeah.
If the instructions are, okay, first kill this guy, then go into that tent, then kill that guy. It's like you've lost him.
Well, he was a smoke baby, just real... like right previous.
Yeah, right. The guy is literally like 2 hours old, if that.
Baby crawls out, gets all big, and they go, okay, now here's what I want you to do. Like, no, I just stop interrupting. No, like, all right, look, you focus, all right? And they're like explaining, I want you to wipe out the army. And he's like stabbing it with his smoke fingers in the sand. Like, yeah, no, that's not it. It's not over. To me, that seems like a good balance. I think that grounds it a little bit, right?
All right. So this episode, I think, addresses a little bit of your concerns about magic. And let me see how you feel about it. So sure. Smoke Man comes in, kills Renly. And all of a sudden, this alliance between the Starks and Baratheons fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
And so then your concern last week was, all right, so then just Smoke Man your way to the Iron Throne.
Right.
But in this episode, what they did was Smoke Man leaves. He makes his exit. And then you've got Davos saying, don't do it. If you keep doing it this way, they're going to start worshiping the Red Priest and not you.
Right, right.
And so Stannis commits to going into the next battle without the
smoke
Red.
Free.
Yeah, he's smoke free. He's given it up cold turkey.
Yeah, that's hard, man.
So they're kind of baking a political rule into the world whereby you can't just Smoke Man your way out of every situation.
Right.
Does this help you at all?
It helps a little, but at the same time, I'm like, yeah, but I mean, it's real easy to be like, I'm not going to use the Smoke Man when you got a Smoke Man.
Yeah,
like,
that's right. The next time.
Yeah.
The next time Stannis is in this situation, you're like, oh, how stupid. You had a Smoke Man. And you
They start throwing bowls full of napalm or medieval napalm at you. Uh-huh. And you're like, well... Unleash the Smoke Man.
Okay, what about this? The implication here is that Stannis' seed inseminates the Smoke Man.
Sure.
All right.
Okay.
What if Stannis...
I'll allow it.
All right. You know, because they have sex on the war table and whatnot, right?
Sure.
And then she births the smoke baby. What if Stannis has a little bit of a performance problem?
Oh, and so you're saying that the smoke baby was immaculate?
Well, no, I'm saying it worked that one time, but the next time he tries to get a Smoke Man going.
Well, is the Smoke Man, like, is it a disposable Smoke Man? How many uses do you get? Like, is this like if you're playing a game and you have a card, you can use it strategically, but you don't get to keep the card once you use it.
Right.
So I'm in the spot where it's like, okay, so Stan is like, fine, no Smoke Man. Well, you know, the Red priestess is still out there. Like, she could be like, well, you know, we have a responsibility, you know, and the Smoke Man's like, I didn't ask to be birthed. And so, I don't know. I mean, like, can the Smoke Man change? I mean, there's a lot. I mean, obviously, I feel like we're not done with the Smoke Man, because, I mean, the smoke, he's there. He's out there. He's...
Well, or he just dissipated.
Okay.
Yeah, it's like a card. It's like, Stannis played his Smoke Man card, and now it's in the discard pile.
Right. So, I mean, I can get on board with that. If that was explicit, now I don't know what's going to happen, obviously, but like, if that was it, like, she's like, oh, I need another Smoke Man. It's like, all right, get to the war table, Melisandre.
I mean, you think, yeah, exactly. You think, well, he just can create another card. He can draw another card from the deck.
Yeah, that's a good point.
All right. Anything more to say about Smoke Man at this point?
It sets into motion a lot, obviously, but so one king down.
So one king down, so Renly's certainly not going to sit on the Iron Throne.
Unless it's as a goof.
Unless it's... unless he becomes the Smoke Man.
Yeah, unless it's like Weekend at Renly's.
That's right. Yes. All right. So we talked a lot about Joffrey's name day present.
Mm-hmm.
And what he does... with these prostitutes, and it's really, it's almost like it's Tyrion and Bronn mention it in passing.
Yeah, just anecdotally.
It's like it's a throwaway line.
Yeah, for a scene that was, to your point, was like, you felt it was gratuitous because we kind of know where we stand. So you build this scene up. Again, my point, I think, echoed your sentiment, which is, don't need it. No one's wondering, you know, well, is Joffrey just misunderstood? Like, nobody likes Joffrey.
Right, yeah.
So the thought I had was like, okay, that becomes important if that does something dramatic to the Tyrion-Joffrey relationship.
Right.
And it didn't seem to at all.
Well, Tyrion says he's a lost cause.
Right. Sure. Right.
So it could be that, you know, so Bronn and Tyrion had the idea. Let's see if we can sort of give him a sexual pressure valve. And clearly it didn't help. It didn't help matters. And so they're now writing Joffrey off as a lost cause.
Well, it feels too like
we already knew, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think maybe so here's where I will at least, you know, and this may be a reverse engineering, but like with Tyrion, I mean, at the end of the day, Tyrion is his uncle, right? I don't ever get the sense that he has real strong familial feelings for Joffrey. But if there was anything lingering, this was kind of like, all right, yeah, he's just a monster. Kind of what I thought. I thought I'd give it one more. Like, if it turns out that all of a sudden Joffrey comes out and he's like, uncle, thank you so much for the name day present. Suddenly it's like, well, maybe that changes how I approach this guy. Maybe I can influence him as an uncle as opposed to having to do it this other way. But I think there is something to be said for how sort of dismissive it was. Like, he's a lost cause. It's like, which is fascinating because he's the king. He's the one by which you have to navigate around or through, and they just sort of dismiss it. So I think it seals the deal that Tyrion is like, all right, fine. I'm not going to be able to save him. Mm. So I'll just go with the plan that I had before. I'm running this show. I don't really care about him. I'll deal with him accordingly. Like, there's something about that it adds a little more. As disappointing as it was to see the lack of closure, it introduces a new element very subtly.
I did appreciate the street preacher.
Mm-hmm.
Because we really don't ever get a whole lot of the perspective of the common folk, right?
Right.
And here they are, from a street preacher's perspective, from the commoner's perspective, we see that all of the people at court, they're all in the same boat. You know, we know that Joffrey's a monster, but from their perspective, Tyrion's a demon monkey. It's not
a demon
like,
monkey.
Yeah, it's not. That's a difficult reputation to live in.
Well, I think it's kind of, I think it's a very compelling moment because... to your point, we haven't seen the commoners because as far as all the folks in court are concerned, they're all the same person.
Right. And you can have different evil dictators that are that way for different reasons. So you've got people at court who do evil things, but they think that they're the good guy, like Tyrion, right?
And that's an important moment right there, where all of a sudden Tyrion's like, wait, I'm trying to save these people. And again, even based on that is just sort of like, why waste my, I don't have to waste my nuance on these folks. I'm doing good. They should just be appreciative. So there is still that royal disconnect, but there is a moment of maybe some awareness of like, huh, you know, I mean, that, and so that becomes an important dynamic as well, I think. Just
because. See, I think that, I mean, I think clearly Tyrion's everyone's favorite character, but the big picture is that this is the guy that is most responsible for keeping Joffrey on the throne.
Right.
And Joffrey's a monster, and that makes Tyrion, for better or worse, a demon monkey, because even though we like him and he's a good guy, he's doing the most to promote the power of someone like Joffrey.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a big problem with what's going on up north, Steve.
All right.
So we go back up north.
Are we talking north? The whole Theon is.
No. I mean north of the wall, like beyond where the Fist of the First Men.
Mm-hmm.
And we meet a Quorn Halfhand. And I'm interested in that character. Like, John really idolizes. Quorin kind of looks like the prototypical ranger, and he's always wanted to be a ranger. And he can survive for a full winter beyond the wall. And so he's sort of this heroic character in John's eyes, right?
Right.
In reality, Steve, he's the only one wearing a hat.
Huh.
I've got a big problem with all of these people up north not wearing hats.
Yeah.
Of course they're going to die up north. They're not wearing hats.
Well, but that just shows how much why he is to be respected, right?
Yeah. Put on a hat.
It's a simple thing.
You can survive in the snow. Put on a hat.
It's the thing that's the only thing that separates him from everybody else. Is like,
you have Lord Mormont who's leading the whole crew. He's bald and he's not wearing a hat.
Yeah, it's like, they're like, is he a great soldier? No, but for some reason, like, well, everybody else is just chattering. He seems to be fine. Almost sweating, even. He may be half hand, but he's full hat.
He's full hat. I just, you know, it's just one of those things where, look, I know the camera likes a full head of hair. I know that. But you're up north, man. Put on a hat.
Just kidding. They have hats.
A hood, anything. I don't care. Put a raccoon on your head. I don't care.
I'm sure the book discusses the hat in much more detail. It's like three pages on the hat.
I'd like to talk a little bit about Jack and Hagar.
Okay.
Do you know who I mean when I say Jack and Hagar?
Probably not.
So he was the guy in a cage that Arya.
Saves. In the burning cage.
At this point in the story, we're supposed to think that he's Lorathi because he doesn't use like regular pronouns. He just says a man does this.
Super progressive.
A girl does this. Yes, he's got a very, very clear sense of which pronouns he's comfortable with. Right. So his claim is that the Red God was robbed of three deaths. He's a little bit of like a genie in a bottle. He's granting Arya three wishes.
Yeah.
Right? And we know that she's got this death list.
She does have a death list. And she burns a wish off her list.
Here's the problem with that, Steve. You would think that she would, but if you look at the list, the Tickler's not on the list.
That's what I'm saying. She burns it off. It's not on the list.
Yeah, not on the list. So this is kind of an argument among the fans. Did she waste a wish? I mean, what was the motivation for using that particular wish on someone who's not on her list?
I saw it as a, look, if you say Joffrey, right now the odds of that happening are down the road.
Uh-huh.
If you say Cersei, same thing. Anybody that is away, right, there's no way to know. You got to find out now, is this guy for real?
Right.
Is he for real? It's a go get it. If you're willing to do it, go get it right here. It's right around the corner.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, my case has always been...
She's also a kid, right?
That was always my argument. My argument was always like, you're expecting a little bit too much from this kid. And not only she's a kid, she's a traumatized kid. And what do you expect? She's not she's not going to be as strategically minded as you would be in that particular situation.
Right.
But I have a different take on this now after rewatching this. I think that the reason why she doesn't choose someone on her list is because she wants to
do it.
She wants to do it by her own hand.
Yeah.
And you kind of get that in that sense of her telling Tywin anyone can be killed.
Mm-hmm.
And she stares at him like a little bit too long.
You know, watch it, man. I can always add to my list.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it links her pretty well with Rob at this point, right? This is sort of the cascading effect of Ned's death. I think Rob is, he's got to avenge his father. Then if you start to rank the Stark children in terms of strategy, you know, because we don't know for sure. Is Arya just hellbent on revenge? She wants to do it on her own, or does she have a plan?
I mean, we were talking about the different kids from Winterfell, right? So Arya's clearly an interesting, for her age, she's something like of a strategic prodigy, if my interpretation is right. I don't think at this point Jon is very strategically minded. I think he needs someone like Sam to like connect the dots for him.
Yeah.
Like he's making you a steward for a reason, dummy. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I also think that Sans is a little bit behind at this point, although we're not quite seeing what's going on with her internally. Well, we have one of these kids, Bran, who might be dreaming symbolically about the future, but doesn't really know what to do with the information yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's now just, he's got some counsel, but I mean, his family's left him, right? I mean, he's kind of created his own new little, it's a sort of misfit toy island here.
And then lowest on the list of strategically minded is Rickon, who he just wants to smash the hell out of walnuts.
No, I mean,
that's his goal.
Suddenly there's a much more sinister character that shows up in Winterfell.
He just has it in for those nuts, man.
He hates food. I mean, imagine that kind of
moral compass. That's an assault against nature itself.
Moral compass be damned. It's just like, I don't like food anymore.
Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info. Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
This week's Bird's Eye View comes to you in the form of a question for discussion. As always, email me at book@baldmove.com or go to the forums and start a new thread for this. if you have any thoughts. This week, I suggested that Cat was the real cat's paw in Littlefinger's plot. A cat's paw, of course, is someone used unwittingly by another as a tool. But of course, by this definition, we could say that lots of people qualify as Littlefinger's cat's paw. At the risk of overtaxing the pun, I will also point out that Cat does indeed hurt her paw in this chapter. Now, if you're rolling your eyes at this point, I definitely feel you, but you have to ask, are you rolling your eyes at the interpretation or at the author's intent? Consider the following pun names in Martin's world. First, Lysa Arryn. First name is spelled L-Y-S-A. Reading ahead, we learn that Lysa was involved in the assassination of John, who was, of course, killed by a poison named the Tears of Lice, L-Y-S. Here, no doubt, this is an intentional breadcrumb by Martin. Or consider that Bran can be translated as crow or raven in Welsh. Gotta be intentional. Martin has confirmed being inspired by the War of the Roses, which has a plot concerning the Yorks and the Lancasters. Thus, phonetically, we have the inspiration for the so-named Starks and Lannisters. Tyrion comes from the Greek Tyre, which can be traced to the Phoenician Tsor, literally meaning rock or rocky place. No coincidence here. That he comes from Casterly Rock, often just shortened to the Rock. Sam, I'm convinced, is cribbed from an almost identical character in Lord of the Rings. And then, of course, sticking with Lord of the Rings, we could say that Dario's last name is Naharis. Now, fans of Lord of the Rings will remember that Nahar is a divine horse. Interesting, then, that Dario is cast as a master horseman in the books on the show and becomes the love interest of our favorite Khaleesi. Bronn, don't let the spelling fool you, functions as the brawn to Tyrion's brain. And what about Roose Bolton? Can you really ever trust a man named Roose? I mean, if the word was spelled R-U-S-E, it means an action intended to deceive. Okay, so even if we grant that a few of these are a stretch, I think we can say with confidence that Martin likes pun names, and that his names sometimes reveal future plot points. So to my question. Are there other names like this? Which names have I missed? I'm looking specifically for names that could function as pun names either by etymology or by phonetics, and possibly point to future plot reveals. Looking forward to hearing from you, and that's all for this week.